Tonight on Arena, Miss Scarlet and the Duke, a new TV drama series from Shinawil Productions, and we review the new Sebastian Barry novel, A Thousand Moons. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A lady should always act like a lady, so says Eliza Scarlett, as a glass eye falls out of her sleeve while she's pouring tea. Outward decorum is vital in Miss Scarlet and the Duke, a new period detective drama about the daughter of a private investigator in Victoria, London. It was filmed in Dublin and it airs from tomorrow evening on Alibi, the TV channel. Joining me is creator and showrunner Rachel New, actor Kathy Belton, who plays one of the roles in the series, and Larry Bass from the production company Shinawil, who are very much part of the Miss Scarlet and the Duke stable. Rachel, I'll start with you, since it's she and it are your creation, Miss Scarlet and the Duke. And I suppose it's fair to say this isn't your typical period drama. She's an unusual character, is Miss Scarlet.
She certainly is. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. Very excited to be on. Yes, she really is. She is different. She's a force of nature. So she's not your regular Victorian demure lady. She's got a bit of scrappiness to her, a bit feisty. And I think the main thing with Eliza is it's 1882. Her father has died and pretty much left her penniless. And she has a choice of either marrying for financial security or owning her own money, paying her own bills and being financially independent, doing a job she knows she can be good at. So that's the kind of dilemma we join her at.
Victorian England was a difficult place for a young woman with any kind of independent spirit or independent mind to live in, not least because financial independence and economic independence was practically impossible. Did you have particular models in mind for Eliza?
Not really. Eliza was very much a combination of lots of different people. There was a bit of me in there. There was some of my favourite characters, Elizabeth Bennet, Jane Austen's Elizabeth Bennet, Scarlett O'Hara. So I just wanted to put a woman who was progressive and ambitious and put her in a time when women had little or no rights. I think there's something really fascinating about watching somebody having to operate within the limits of their world. And in drama terms, it creates lots of lovely conflict, which is exactly what any writer wants. But yes, the main thrust of the story is, a woman in a man's world trying to survive, trying to stay in the game.
And even men that we might even half like, or certainly on the basis of the first episode, I find myself half liking William, who's the character, the detective played by Stuart Martin. And we get a real sense in that first episode that there's a bit of chemistry between himself and Eliza. But let's listen to a clip quite early on in the episode, in fact, where Stuart Martin's character is pointing out to Eliza that she really shouldn't be pursuing the type of job that she seems to think she can pursue.
I know of your little hobby, paying street boys for tip-offs of crime scenes. Being a detective is a job for a man, Eliza.
And yet you do it every day, William.
Well, nice as this is, I have many cases to attend to, so...
Yes, I can see how busy you are. You still have soap on your neck.
An arson attack on the city's largest opium den. Six schoolgirls smuggled to the continent for brothel fodder, and a dead man floating in Regent's Park Canal with his throat slit ear to ear.
I've seen neater cuts from a one-armed butcher.
A lady should not see such things.
And with his pocket watch still on his person, it's clearly not the work of a common thief.
Oh.
I would say it's a crime of passion by a scorned woman, since the rash on the soles of his feet suggests latter stage of syphilis. His mistress, perhaps, but more likely his wife. Of course, I'm sure you've already considered this.
Of course, I have.
Good day, William.
Frank! Bring in the wife for questioning.
And there we have Stuart Martin as the character of William Wellington. And earlier in the clip, you heard Kate Phillips as the character of Miss Scarlet from the new TV series, Miss Scarlet and the Duke. And the show's creator, Rachel New, is on the line with me now, along with Kathy Belton and Larry Bass, both of whom are involved in the production in different ways. But he's really going to have to up his game, is William, if he's going to keep up with Eliza on the basis of that clip. I was mentioning chemistry. That's going to grow, I'm guessing, Kate.
Yes, it's very much one of the sort of very central to the story, this crackle and sizzle between these two people who essentially are each other's family. William Wellington was Eliza's father's young protege when he was a detective inspector at Scotland Yard. And they put up with each other, really. They're kind of stuck with each other, but there is a friendship there and there is something sizzling between them, and we kind of develop that as the season goes on. But in terms of their screen chemistry, Kate and Stuart were amazing, I have to say. They were just incredible. And they had so much fun as well in the scene, so that was really, that made it even more, you know, tangible.
Yeah, I often wonder about that when you're in the process of casting for a series like this. Obviously, particularly between the two of them. Now, I've only seen an episode, so I'm not sure, but I do think it's going to be a big part of the story as the season goes on. How much of an accident is that chemistry? And how much is it, you know, because you're obviously thinking of both characters separately, but you do have to think of them together. How much of an accident is it? How much of a joy is it when you see that your accident actually has happened?
It's a really tricky one. I mean, these characters have been in my head for such a long time. And when I saw Kate, I was mad about Wolf Hall and The Crown. I just felt that she was Eliza. And so we were sort of looking for our Duke, and Kate and I were in a hotel in London meeting Stuart, and he walked in and straight away I just thought, yeah, he's Duke, he's the one. And I think there is that sort of moment when they're sitting next to each other. I sort of have my producer's hat on as well, thinking they would look amazing in the poster together, and they do. But there's just something, I don't know, I just trusted that it would happen. I mean, it was very unusual because we had no auditions with them. And the first time I actually saw them perform together was at the read-through. So wow. It was kind of a bit late by then, but I had such confidence in them. I'd obviously seen all their work that they'd done before, and they're both very charismatic people, both in real life and on screen. So I was pretty confident about it, and I just think you just know. I just knew. So it may have been an accident. Maybe I'm just an optimist, but thankfully it turned out perfectly.
Yeah, or you've got a good nose.
Perfect.
You've got a good nose for chemistry. There's a very different type of chemistry that exists between Kathy Belton's character. Let's bring in Kathy at this point. Between your character, Kathy Belton.
Hi,
Kathy. How are you? Lovely to speak with you. Ivy,
you too.
who's the housekeeper in the Scarlet household.
Yes.
And she effectively is a kind of surrogate parent. That's a different type of chemistry that you'd be looking for there, I guess.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was so exciting to play. First of all, two women that were left alone living together after the first episode of Victoria London. And I remember when I read the script first going, oh, this is exciting, because she's a surrogate mother, she's a housekeeper, but I think she represents the old world. And it was interesting, Declan O'Dwyer, a wonderful director, and Rachel said that these characters were breaking glass ceilings all the time. And what was really exciting to play with Ivy was to see the inflection and the influence that Miss Scarlet was having in Ivy and her journey, but also that Ivy was the solid old world that represented her father as well. She needed that security to let her ply. So, it was a very exciting chemistry, and Kate was an absolute joy to work with. She's what you call a true star, Sean. She's in so many scenes, and she brought such passion, professionalism, talent every day. And the biggest thing was it was great crack. It was such fun.
Yeah, it really was.
Let's have a listen to a scene, in fact, that features yourself, Kathy, as the character of Ivy, the housekeeper. And this is definitely, you're in mother mode at this point, because Miss Scarlett or Eliza wants to head out in a cab, no less, at an unearthly hour of the night. And you're having none of it.
Dinner is ready, miss.
I don't want any dinner, but I do want you to fetch me a cab.
But the sun is going down. You cannot go out alone. What'll people think?
Let them think what they like.
I've set the table in the dining room, but would you rather eat with us? What's going on?
Miss Scarlett is going out. Alone.
I said go and get me a cab, Kitty.
You can't go out alone. It will be dark soon. It's dangerous.
Kitty?
Kitty, do not move. Oh, you're going to find that gentleman's niece. You should not be doing this.
And you should not be listening at doors. I should let my own cab.
Eliza, this is not the time to fulfil your ambition.
Word will soon spread that my father has died, and any day now, all our accounts will be called in. If I don't take this case, someone else will. This isn't about ambition, Ivy. This is about money. Trust me. I know what I'm doing.
Kate Phillips as Eliza Scarlett and Kathy Belton as Ivy. And I do believe it was poor Emma Willis that was the piggy in the middle there as Kitty, who didn't know who to obey in that scene, Kathy.
I wouldn't blame her. She's on a very tight, a very, very short tightrope.
And I guess you were saying, Kathy, that it's two women in the one household. Now, I don't know how much of a part Emma plays later on in the episodes, but clearly there are three women in the household. Yes. It's a house full of women, really, since there's no father, there's no other male in the household at all.
Yeah, I think that's a really exciting dynamic. And it's really clever, you know, to a little world of matriarchy and a huge patriarch world. The dynamics that can cause is really exciting.
Very much a design on your part, I would have thought, Rachel, to have that all-female environment and see what that threw up.
Oh, absolutely. And can I just say, Kathy is amazing in it. Hello, Kathy.
Hello.
yes, absolutely. I really wanted to explore that. I wanted to, you know, push these women to their limits. And as Kathy was saying, that you know they have their ceilings that they. Kathy, who plays Ivy, is less so. She's a bit more nervous, but you know she is influenced and inspired by Eliza to say, look, we can, you know, we can do better. There's an episode about the women's suffrage and about the women's vote, and I don't want to do any plot spoilers, but that's a rather lovely journey that Ivy goes on to.
Yeah.
So in each episode, you know, I really wanted this to be fun and entertaining, but there are sort of little insights, you know, into socially what was going on politically, you know, at home, at work, and we view it through the eyes of these women.
Yeah, in fact, there's a little scene. It's only a short scene, and again, I'm not going to do any plot spoilers in this. But there's the whole area of what happens when a bordello or a whorehouse is raided by the police, and the prostitutes are all taken in, and the examinations that they would have to have undergone to check for syphilis. Even though you don't go down a very graphic route in that respect, but it's well hinted at that what would be in terms of those examinations, it would not have been pleasant for the women.
I mean, absolutely. It was the Contagious Diseases Act, and it was one of those things. It didn't really, they weren't interested in, you know, what the men were spreading around or the soldiers that would come to the cities. It was more about if you were one of the prostitutes, you were the problem. And you could be banged up for like, you know, a year if you were found to having any kind of disease. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah, I suppose it's only in recent times that we've got to the place where the procurement of sex for money is an offence, in the same way as providing sex for money was considered an offence previous to that as well. Let me bring in Larry Bass at this point, because Larry, while we're speaking about this and have Cathy on the line, there are people who know the Irish acting fraternity will have fun spotting lots of other people in there. Helen Norton, I saw Aidan McCardle in episode 1-2. Nick Dunning will be there later on as well. Just how, explain how we have Victorian London being shot in Dublin.
Hi, Sean. Hello to Cathy and to Rachel as well.
Hi, Larry.
Just, Sean, just when we first seen, and I, you know, we were working with Element 8, who are the producers from Los Angeles, on another show, and they talked about this show. And then they had just cast Kate Phillips. And at that stage, I just asked a question to Patty and Jean, who were working with on this other show, where are you going to shoot? Just out of curiosity. And at that stage, they hadn't fixed on the location. And I said, well, you must look at Dublin. It was the second city of the empire at that time. And there have been lots of other Victorian London shows shot in Dublin. So we get into that conversation, and as we are already working with them on another show, one thing led to another, and it was quite fast in the end. This time last year, effectively, we were closing off, putting together the deal, and the show was in prep fairly quickly and shot last summer, and here we are, looking forward to watching all of the fantastic work that Rachel has written come on screen. And when I say Rachel has created a fantastic precinct that tells and captures a slice of life in a way you've never seen before, it really is remarkable. And then that's all capped off with some fantastic production design that Paddy O'Callaghan did, and Leonia doing costumes, fantastic Irish craft mixing in with great, great scripts. But what Rachel has really, really delivered is fantastic scripts with great humour. There's humour all the way through this. Really fantastic stories.
Yeah, and I suppose the other side, I know I recognise the Crescent in Ranla. There's a Crescent in Ranla that I recognise as a great Victorian spot at one point along the way. And that looks just like London. And I guess, as you say, Larry, the second city of the Empire, why not? But in general, Larry, I mean, obviously this was shot last year, but we're in a very different time now. What effect has the current crisis had on production? Can you continue with pre-production plans for other things, or how are you working?
I think what we can do, obviously, we, most people in Ireland would know us as producers of shows like Dancing with the Stars and other shows.
Is this a first drama for you?
It's the first drama for on the Shine Uile banner. I was involved in dramas many, many years ago on a different banner. And we're delighted and excited about this one, and we've got a few more we hope to bring forward over the next few years. We've had to pause on the production side at the moment because nothing is going to be shot over the next while. On the pre-production side, what you can do is double down and work on scripts and work on pre-production planning and scheduling and financing. So a lot of work can still be done. And I think what Ireland can certainly do in terms of building our industry here is make sure that when this pandemic, you know, passes, and hopefully it'll pass reasonably, you know, quickly. And hopefully I think we've taken some early decisions and correct decisions here in Ireland. And if we can come through this faster than other places, you know, a lot of schedules need to be replaced. A lot of platforms need content, networks right around the world, and it'll be first up, best dressed. So getting your pre-production and scripting done will be critical and important to get schedules back in line and get production rolling again.
Yeah, you'll have to be ready for the opportunities that present themselves. What about you, Cathy? Cathy Belton, how difficult is it for an actor?
Yeah, I think it has been difficult. I was in the middle. I would have been opening in the Gay Theatre on the 1st of April with the Little Foxes, but obviously, like every piece of theatre, everything closed. It was hard, but I feel really optimistic, Sean. I mean, I look at the programme like Arena yourselves. People are throwing themselves back into culture, into poetry, into you know, TV, that I think what we do will be even more important after this, and people will need a lot of healing emotionally, and I think no better place than stories and culture. So, it's scary times, but I feel very optimistic we'll all get through this, and there'll be a need more than ever for what we do.
Now, I didn't hear you the full of your answer there, Cathy, because I'm not quite sure what happened, because my connection went down. As you may know, I'm broadcasting remotely at the moment, so that was why I wasn't reacting to anything you were saying. Okay. But I'm back with you now, so I kind of got the tail end of what you were saying there.
You know, no more than what you were doing now. Certainly in this household, Sean, Arena is our little mass every night, but I think with everything that's gone on, and of course there's a lot of artists out of work and actors out of work, but I really feel positive that people will need to cling more to what we do and to culture, and there's a huge healing in that as well.
And I think, Cathy,
let me finish up
there.
Go ahead, Larry.
I think what you've got is a real opportunity for we're all, you know, working together as a country, from each house in the country, to fight this. And I think coming out of it, we will realise that who we are as a nation can be reflected in our cultural exports. And
Absolutely. This
is a real opportunity to double down on that and really put a value on Creative Ireland and actually take it out to the world. And we can be, the place that people come to make the future films, TV series, and tell stories that resonate and really entertain and educate.
Sean, I was going to say, I can vouch for that.
I thought filming in Ireland was exceptional. The crews were incredible. They were like a well-oiled machine. They were really something. Everybody was just fabulous. They were so on their game. Not just Larry and Cathy, who obviously were fantastic, but just all of their teams, everyone around, everybody involved in this show. I can only speak for this show, but I was so impressed, and I would have no hesitation. Hopefully we will be back with Miss Scarlet, but if I was lucky enough to have another show on, Ireland would be my number one choice. I just thought it was fantastic.
I think we're a nation of storytellers, and I think we're clinging to that at the moment. And in the words of Seamus Heaney, if we can winter this out, we can summer anywhere.
Once long ago, when we were even more clueless.
And that's a track, Yes We Will, a duet between John Prine and Maria Doyle Kennedy. And my connection went down just as I was telling you about that track. In fact, music fans, of course, will be aware that the singer and songwriting legend John Prine is in a critical condition at the moment with symptoms of coronavirus. Best wishes to him and his wife, Fiona Whelan Prine. Fiona had confirmed 10 days ago that she had contracted the virus and that herself and her husband were quarantining separately. I cannot imagine how difficult that is. John Prine, a hugely respected artist and Grammy winner, 2019 inductee in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, collaborated with many Irish artists, including Declan O'Rourke, on a song called Let's Make Love. Let's Make Big Love, I beg your pardon. And of course, in 2012, then with Maria Doyle Kennedy in the song you just heard, Yes We Will, which she included in her album of that year. And I also believe you missed out on my telling you where you could watch the Miss Scarlet and the Duke. It's available on, I think, most basic packages if you are either on Sky or Virgin Media. It's on channel 132 on Sky, that's Alibi Channel. And on Virgin Media, it's on channel 151. Wexford Festival Opera has a new artistic director, Rosetta Cucci, and she has recently announced her programme for the 2020 festival, which, all things being well and back to normal, we really hope that festival will take place in November. And Rosetta is joining me, I believe, from Italy. We'll get on to the programme for Wexford at the moment. But you're in Italy this evening, are you, Rosetta?
Yes, I'm in Italy. Thank you for having me. It's very tough in Italy at the moment, as you can see. Mm-hmm. And we are locked down since 3 weeks, so we are getting used to cocooning, as you say. But it's difficult. It's difficult. And I think we will get through of this. And probably when this will pass, everybody will be better. We'll be better human being, probably.
Where are you in Italy, Rosetta?
I'm in Pesaro, which is the town where Rossini was born, is on the Adriatic Sea, is in the center of Italy, but still is quite a hot spot for the COVID. So we are really locked down. I have 3 dogs, and my only allowed things is to walk the dogs within 200 meters from my house. So this restriction will allow us to get through. And I'm glad to hear that Ireland is taking the big restriction as well, because this is the only way to make this go and be better, you know.
And I also, I'm sure you saw the pictures on television, as we did here in Ireland, of people standing on their balconies and singing. I mean, it's moving even to think of it. Singing
I did it.
Great
I op- did it as
you
well.
Did it yourself.
Absolutely.
Do tell me about that.
From my balcony, we sang Vincerò, which is the end of Turandot, myself and all the house apartments beside me, because this is a way of throw out the energies and being positive and thinking positive. This is mainly important to keep up the energy and to be positive. And this is what we are doing. It was strange to sing from a balcony, since I'm not a singer, but, you know, I did it.
And Vincerò from the end of Turandot, people will recognize it's the end of Nessun Dorma, isn't it? The great footballing song. But Vincerò
yes,
means we will conquer, we will win through.
Yeah, exactly. We will win. As the song that you were transmitting before, we will win.
Yeah, well, hopefully we will all win and we will all be well at the end of all of this. But let us talk then a little bit about your upcoming programme for the 2020 Wexford Festival Opera, Rosetta. I suppose the first thing is, you are no stranger to Wexford. I mean, you have been really in and associated with Wexford for a very long time.
For a very long time. Actually, Wexford was more or less my first job. I arrived in Wexford when I was, let's say, in my early 20s in 1995, and that was my springboard for everything, for me as a pianist, for me as a stage director, and for me as an artistic director as well. So I'm very familiar with Wexford. I could say that Wexford is my second home. Lots and lots of friends are there. So when I come back to Wexford, it's like to come back to my Brigadoon. Something that appear in the middle of the nowhere, but is so magic that you cannot do without it.
And in fact, if I'm right, that first assignment in Wexford, or an involvement with Wexford back in the 1990s, involved the great Peruvian tenor Juan Diego Flores, who was coming as part of your tenure. He's coming to give masterclasses, I believe, this autumn.
Yes. Myself and Juan Diego, we are very close friends. And actually, in the summertime, we are living both in Pesaro. He has an house here. And he started his career both in Pesaro, in Rossini Opera Festival, which is the festival every year happening in the summertime, and in Wexford in the same year. So we arrived together in Wexford, and I remember Juan Diego singing in the pub, standing on a table, singing O Sole Mio, and then he became probably the most famous tenor in the world. But he didn't forget Wexford. And so when I said, look, Diego, I'm doing a new academy, which will be the Wexford Factory. Would you like to come and be a master class and do something for us? And he accepted with joyful and happiness to come back in a place that was somehow a springboard for him. And he has a wonderful remember about Wexford as well. So, yes, we will have him in September doing a masterclass for our students of the Wexford Factory, yes.
Yeah, the Wexford Factory is that project that you're speaking about. And indeed, if Juan Diego Flores wants to stand on a chair in a pub, in a studio, on the street or anywhere and sing O Sole Mio, I will stand underneath him with a microphone and make sure that I record that. What an exciting thing that would be to get. Now, your theme for this year's festival, you've brought this idea of giving a theme, and the theme is Shakespeare, connections with Shakespeare. Why that, Rosetta?
Because Shakespeare actually is certainly the most operatic poet of the theatre history. I mean, in every opera that by Shakespeare, you can find all the feelings that you can find in every plot of opera. I mean, madness, jealousy, tragic love. So lots and lots of composers in the last two centuries have written operas about Shakespeare or by Shakespeare. So it would be the perfect playwright to whom intitulate my first festival. And this was the reason, because the research of the three operas that I've done during the last year was to research three different opera that gives three faces of Shakespeare. And this is what I did, more or less, actually. I found an opera which will be open the festival, which is Ein Wintermärchen. And this is a winter tale, so is by Shakespeare, and is one of the most beautiful plays by Shakespeare. And then another opera that is called Les Songes d'une nuit d'été, in French. And this is an opera that the translation is A Midsummer Night Dream. But actually it's not Midsummer Night Dream at all. It's just a story about Shakespeare. It talks about a kind of merrymaking author in search of love that is under the inspiration of a mysterious muse who turns out to be the Queen Elizabeth. The Queen Elizabeth, at the end, will transform this merrymaking author to a national poet. So it's a kind of Shakespeare in love.
And, I was going to say that.
It's beautiful because, yes, exactly. It's very look like to Shakespeare in love. And then the third, so an opera about Shakespeare. And then the third opera is Edmea by Alfredo Catalani. This is apparently doesn't have nothing to do with Shakespeare because it doesn't come from Shakespeare and doesn't speak about Shakespeare. But when I read the story, I found this story so Shakespearean because it tells about a woman that is losing her mind for love. She throws herself in a lake. She is saved by a traveler's actor that bring her with them around in the castle. So it reminds me of Ophelia, and it reminds me the Midsummer Night Dream. So It was exactly an opera that with a Shakespearean story. And more than this, Edmea by Catalani. Catalani was one of the best friends of a conductor that I loved immensely, which is Toscanini. Toscanini first read this opera on the piano, and he said that this is a masterpiece. And after that, he premiered this opera in Turin. And then the two of them, Toscanini and Catalani, became very close friends for all the life. So I said, a touch of a great composer, a touch of a great conductor together will be successful.
And of course, Catalani, I think most people would be familiar with Catalani from the aria Eben Neandro Lontana, which was such an important part of Jean-Jacques Benet's film Diva. Are there any beautiful lyrical arias like that in the opera that you're presenting by Catalani, Edmea?
Oh, yes. There is the aria of Edmea that is really beautiful and will be sung by a person, an artist that has been in Wexford before, which is Anne-Sophie Duprelz. Anne-Sophie was the protagonist of Resurrezione in 2017, and that was one of the few standing ovations that I ever seen in Wexford. So she will come back to sing this at MEA, and I'm very proud to have her in our festival in 2020, yes.
It sounds as if you are going back in some ways to the original way we thought of Wexford, Rosetta Cucci, new artistic director of the Wexford Festival Opera. You're going back to this idea of finding these almost lost treasures, these lesser known operas, and bringing them out to the public again, which is something you had done previously, I think, in a festival in Lugo in Italy. You were involved in this type of, you know, finding these lost gems.
Bravo, exactly. My name is Rosetta Cucci, like the biscuits, not Cucci.
Cucci, I beg your pardon. Yeah, Cucci is a different thing, isn't it? That's term of endearment. Cucci, I shall call you from now on.
Cucci, you will remember forever, like the biscuits, you know.
Like the biscuit.
So, yes, I was in Lugo and I've been artistic director in Lugo for 10 years. And Lugo was very similar to Wexford. We were looking for rare opera, and above all for rare opera from the early 20th century. So we have put it on stage, really rarities that sometimes we had a co-production with Wexford. We did a Mercadante opera together. This is really long time ago. And so, yes, I'm familiar with rarity. And above all, I think that Wexford is born to find gems, to find something that nobody has listened before, or at least in the modern time. So those three operas actually are really rare. And I'm happy to come back to this tradition of Wexford. But this year, instead of saying, there is this quote that say, one for the brain, one for fun, and one for heart. This year we can say a story about, a story by, a story like. So we will go around Shakespeare in a different, you know, phases.
Well, just one final question then. One final question, Rosetta, if I could. It's no secret that Wexford had experienced financial difficulties, particularly following the 2018 festival. In some ways, is going back to basics, going back to what Wexford does best, is part of that in the hope that you can get those finances back in order?
Yes. As you know, in every country, in every theatre, it happens. It happens because we are depending from, you know, money that comes from development, money that comes from every part, the government, another part. Of course, sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes there is a perfect storm where everything is not going well. And sometimes there is the perfect moment where everything will go well. Now, please God, I hope that this COVID will not affect us. I'm praying because this COVID will not affect us. But in reality, the COVID will affect everybody in one way or in the other. So my fingers are crossed to make this possible. And we will really... we'll do our best.
Well, we wish you the very best in all of that. You're in Pesaro, at home in Pesaro, the home of Rossini this evening, Rosetta. So how better to finish than with a little bit of Rossini? How do you fancy Thomas Hampson and his version of Largo al Fatodum from Rossini's Barber of Seville?
Fantastic. Perfect.
Well, okay. And that's for Rosetta Cucci, who shall never, ever be called anything else by me other than that from now on. Grazie mille. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. That's Rosetta Cucci, Artistic Director of the Wexford Festival Opera, which incidentally runs this year from October the 20th through until November the 1st. WexfordOpera.com will give you all of the details, but I did promise Thomas Hampson and Largo al Fatodum. Let's have it. Pep un barbiere, di qualità. There we go, Thomas Hampson, having lots of fun from the Largo Al Factotum from Rossini's Barber of Seville and wexfordopera.com for full details of everything happening in October and November. And we'll be back with Sebastian Barry's A Thousand Boons after these. Sebastian Barry has just published his new novel, A Thousand Moons. It's a sequel to Days Without End, which told the story of Thomas McNulty and John Cole and was set in the American Indian Wars and the Civil War of the 1860s. This time around, the action has moved 10 years forward and the story is told from the perspective of Winona, the adopted daughter of Thomas and John. She lives with them on a farm in Tennessee. Adele Coffey has been reading A Thousand Moons and she joins me now from Galway. A sequel of sorts is what we have here. Adele, how essential is it to know what happened in Days Without End to get into this book?
It's not essential at all, Sean. It's useful, I suppose, and it enriches the reading of this book if you have read Days Without End. But this story is a complete standalone story and it focuses entirely, almost entirely, on Winona. So the characters from the previous book, Thomas McNulty and John Cole, they're there, but they're there in a very peripheral setting. They're there as her parents, and that is their main role. We don't really get too deep into their characters, into their backgrounds. So it's all about Winona. And at the time we meet her, she is 17, she thinks, because she doesn't really know what age she is. And they're all living on a tobacco farm in Tennessee. And she's, you know, getting to that age where she's interested in love and romance. And she meets a guy who she thinks she likes. And then something terrible happens. She's assaulted and raped and arrives home at the farm with absolutely no memory of the event and no idea who has done this to her. And that's kind of where the action of the story takes off and we go from there. And it almost becomes like a mystery story in a way.
Yeah, because I saw that you were saying this idea that there's almost a murder mystery side to this, if you like, or I suppose a crime thriller aspect to it, which doesn't seem at home with Sebastian Barry's beautiful lyrical language.
No, and I suppose it's almost misleading to say that because it is a classic Sebastian Barry novel in that you have all the beautiful language, all the beautiful descriptions and images, and it is very, very lyrical. But the pace of the novel, this kind of propulsive pace, is driven by the idea that Winona she has no memory around the event and she's desperately trying to find a sense of justice for herself and some peace of mind as well. And for the reader as well, Sebastian Barry very skillfully sort of reveals different clues and makes us think, oh, was it this person? Was it that person? So there are definitely elements of that genre in this book, but he just manages to splice it with his wonderful language.
Tell me a little bit about Winona. I suppose the important thing to remember here is that Winona was and is a Native American adopted by these two men. So injustice and prejudice are very much part of what she experiences and what she tells us about.
Yes, and you know, so she was adopted by them after there was this huge massacre on her tribe, and it included the death of the murder of her mother and her sister. So she lost her entire family, and then went to live with these guys who were responsible in a way for the death of her entire tribe. But she doesn't have any ill feeling towards them, and she loves them deeply, and they've kind of given her the replacement family that she never had. In terms of her status in the society, like, it's a dangerous time to be a woman, obviously, in that sort of mid-19th century America, Wild West vibe. And it's also a very dangerous time to be an Indian woman because she had no status whatsoever. She's not seen as a citizen in the eyes of the law, and she's seen as, you know, a kind of a wolf is how she's described mostly. She's seen as an animal, somebody who doesn't have human feelings and doesn't have any rights whatsoever. So it's really extreme, and the reader gets very emotionally involved with that and the injustice of it all. But also it's very interesting because it kind of does represent in a more exaggerated form, or maybe not that exaggerated in some cases, it does represent a lot of contemporary issues, and a lot of things come to mind from both the sexual assault aspect, you know, the fact that she's She was drunk when it happened, so she doesn't remember. And also there's the trauma aspect, she doesn't remember. But it is very reminiscent of a lot of recent accounts of sexual assaults where, you know, people can't remember because there was alcohol involved. So, again, it feels very relevant a lot of the time.
Yeah, because in some ways you could argue that Days Without End was a way of, he essentially in that book, Sebastian Barry wrote about these two gay men and their coupledom and how they lived together all in and around the time of the marriage referendum and you know, the equal status of same-sex marriage that was brought through in that referendum. You could argue that it was a very contemporary novel in that respect. You're saying that this novel then is doing the same thing around a whole host of other contemporary issues.
Yes, I think it is. And it's very interesting that I think that's just what historical fiction does. But I think for Sebastian Barry, his thing has always been to sort of take an inspiration from a distant member of his family and take that as his jumping off point. And I think in this case it was Thomas McNulty, but I don't think there's any real connection to this Winona character. But yeah, it does feel really like, and not just from the female issues or the sexual assault issues and the race issues, but also things like poverty. I mean, there's a line in it at one point where they're talking about if you're poor in America, anyone can do anything to you. And that kind of struck a note, particularly in Trump's America, I thought.
And this idea, you know, we've had a lot of criticism recently, I suppose. I'm thinking in particular of Jeannie Cummins on American Dirt, you know, this idea about writing about an experience that isn't your own. The experience that Sebastian Barry is writing about here, particularly around the character of Winona, is clearly quite far from his own. Did that bother you in any way?
Like, you could not get further from his own experience. I mean, he's white, Irish male. Do you know what? It's a really touchy subject. And I find it quite interesting that nobody has mentioned it really about Sebastian Barry yet. From a personal opinion, I actually have no issue with any author writing any perspective whatsoever, because I think what are you left with then? Fiction is fiction, and if you can't make things up, you're only left with autobiography. So it didn't bother me, but and also I think, you see, Sebastian Barry is very good at writing authentic feeling and sounding characters. So, but I don't know. I'm white, I'm Irish, I'm female. I can't say with any certainty whether this is an authentic account, but it feels authentic emotionally. And Sebastian Barry has commented on it to say that, you know, we're all human, so we do have that connection. And I think that's where he succeeds as a writer, is every, and particularly in the last book as well, how he made those relationships so beautiful was to just, you just read them as two people, you know, and that's obviously how it should be read. And that's the same with this, you know, there's a love story in this book as well. I'm sure Sebastian Barry fans will be pleased to hear that. And again, it's quite intoxicating, but it stays more to the periphery. Yeah. It's not as central as in the last book.
As in the previous book. And you have a feeling, you said you'd have a sense at the end of this book that these are characters that Sebastian Barry will return to, Adele.
I've no reason for saying that apart from just my reading of the book. I don't know if it's the case at all, but I did feel at the end of this book that it kind of, I felt like there was more to be said. It felt like this was maybe the middle of a trilogy almost.
Yeah,
it felt
so
slightly unfinished or something like that at the end. But I would certainly love to read more of these characters. And I think if you haven't read Days Without End, the characters of Thomas McNulty and John Cole, they're very two-dimensional in this book. They're left very much to the periphery,
right,
and
so
you're missing out. So do read Days Without End.
Read Days Without End first, and then A Thousand Moons. That's your suggestion.
I would.
Okay.
But it's you know what, it's a great read. It's very satisfying. It's very pacey, and it's you know, it's a really quick read as well.
All right, that's the Adele Coffey there speaking to us about the current Sebastian Barry novel, A Thousand Moons, published by Faber and Faber. And that is our lot for this evening. Sorry about the technical difficulties earlier on. They seem to have ironed themselves themselves out. Leah Murphy researched this evening. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tom Murphy was the sound engineer. And tonight's programme produced by Ola McGann.